Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. In his annual address to Congress on this very date, 73 years ago, January 6, 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt presented his reasons for America to become involved in World War II. It took place during his annual address to Congress. He made the case for continued aid to Great Britain and to greater production of war industries at home. In helping England, he said, America was fighting for the universal freedoms that all people possessed, four freedoms. Here is FDR.
In the future days which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt outlining the four freedoms 73 years ago today. This hour of the program, we'll be talking about what the world faced right after his election for an unprecedented third term in 1940. Unprecedented danger, instability, and great uncertainty. And also, we'll spend a great deal of time talking about the ideas that he brought forward in those four freedoms and what came as a result of those. Not only Americans' participation in World War II, but Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the UN Declaration of January 1st, 1942, the Atlantic Charter, designed by Churchill and FDR in 41. So much came from that, and it's something we'll talk about on this anniversary. Our guest is Professor David Woolner. He's a senior fellow and Hyde Park resident historian of the Roosevelt Institute, senior fellow of the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College. He has served as the Roosevelt Institute's executive director. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Woolner. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor David Woolner, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's great to be here today.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. Would you say that perhaps first and foremost, this speech has become so much in so many ways, but was it initially a way for President Roosevelt to gather a reason for America to enter World War II?
Well, very much so. I mean, this speech was given really at the beginning of 1941, as you pointed out. And at that time, of course, the war was undergoing a transition. During the 1930s, as you may know, the United States had passed a series of neutrality laws, which Roosevelt eventually modified in 1939 to allow Great Britain to purchase war material to defend itself on a cash-and-carry basis. And by the end of 1940, the British, as Roosevelt said, were broke. They didn't have the funds or the assets available to continue to purchase war material. And as Britain really was the first line of defense for the United States, Roosevelt came to the conclusion in December of that year that we really had to figure out a way to continue to support Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And he went before the American people and in a very famous news conference at that time said, we must become the great arsenal of democracy. And then, of course, he had to get the Congress to go along with the idea of appropriating the funds needed to create a program that would allow us to send war munitions, et cetera, to Great Britain. And that was, of course, Lend-Lease. So this was part of a major effort to make the American people and the American Congress really recognize what was at stake in this war and what it was really all about. And that's where the Four Freedoms speech came out of those sentiments.
And if you would, please, David, describe more for us the state of the world when he gave this address, the unprecedented third term, and then this unprecedented, I believe you wrote, this danger, instability, and uncertainty. These were terribly scary times.
Very scary times. Remember, you know, Russia was not in the war yet. Hitler seemed unstoppable. He had overrun France in a mere 6 weeks. France had the largest army in the world, the largest air force in the world. And, you know, people were utterly shocked. Once France fell and Hitler had control of Western Europe, he threatened Great Britain, and there was widespread expectation in the summer of 1940 that Britain, too, would fall. But Roosevelt began to feel otherwise and sent Harry Hopkins and others to London to talk to Churchill and develop that close relationship, the special relationship that emerged from the war, and determined ultimately that Britain could survive, and argued with his chiefs of staff for the necessity of sending U.S. war material or continuing to sell U.S. war material at that point to the British, even though some were skeptical that Britain was going to be able to make it.
Mm-hmm. And was there an event or a series of events that led FDR to change from a position of neutrality, and I'm wondering how long he held that position, to a position of we need to enter this?
Well, I think, you know, to really truly understand the nature of the Four Freedoms and actually the nature of the U.S. involvement in the Second World War and what it really means, you have to look to the Great Depression.
Mm.
You know, we tend to forget often that the Great Depression was part of a world economic crisis. This was not confined to the United States. And you had a global economic collapse. And it was a global economic collapse that led to the enemies of democracy, essentially, fascist, totalitarian movements springing up in Europe and Asia that really put democracy under siege in the 1930s. And, you know, the 30s were a terrible decade of international aggression and kind of an assault on democracy, which really climaxed in the outbreak of the war. And then by the time we get to 1941, democracy is practically extinct on the planet. You know, you have very few democracies left in the world. Western Europe has been overrun. Hitler had, by the way, just announced that he was establishing a new order in Europe at the end of 1940. And part of Roosevelt's speech, which is very interesting, the Four Freedoms speech, by the way, which is a part of the State of the Union address of 1941, Roosevelt says, the kind of world that we're seeking to create, he said, was no vision of a distant millennium. It's a definite basis for a kind of world attainable in our own time and generation. That kind of world is the very antithesis of the so-called new order of tyranny, which the dictators seek to create with the crash of a bomb. So he was he was also answering Hitler directly.
Mm-hmm. And basing the Four Freedoms on instead of a new order of tyranny, an order of morality.
Exactly. He called. He said that the order that we seek was a moral order, and it was based on these four fundamental human freedoms that he felt were absolutely essential. So, you know, in a broader context, in the short term, in a sense, these become the war aims of the United States in the Second World War, and it's very interesting. You can read letters of GIs writing back home, talking about fighting for the Four Freedoms.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. And, of course, Norman Rockwell popularized this with his famous painting, so that it really became a very powerful message during the war itself. But it's also, you know, it's also part of a much larger story, as I said. The Great Depression convinced Roosevelt and the Roosevelt administration of a couple of things. One, that economic depravity or deprivation was really at the root cause of the Second World War. and therefore, and this, in a sense, also reflects Roosevelt's thinking during the Great Depression, because, you know, he returns to this theme time and time again, even from his first inaugural, going right up through until 1944-45. He speculates, or he talks a little bit about how the United States has changed. We're no longer an agrarian society, and that the framers of the Constitution had it right when they protected freedom of speech and freedom of religion, but they didn't anticipate a modern industrial society in which you had really extreme inequality of wealth and the exploitation of working people that really necessitated a new kind of thinking and new kinds of protections. And this is where he gets into the idea that we can't just have political freedom and religious freedom. We need freedom from want. We need freedom from poverty. And in a world where there had been years of active aggression on the part of these anti-democratic regimes, freedom from fear.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Woolner, when you write about the troops writing home about the Four Freedoms, where were they hearing about them? Was it a part of printed literature or something that they were receiving?
Well, it was very, very popular speech. It was disseminated in all kinds of venues, Time Magazine. There were pamphlets, et cetera. Of course, by the time Americans were fighting in the war, you know, the Four Freedoms were already a year old. He gave this speech before we had actually entered the war. But it's very much a part of his thinking, which, as I said, is very consistent. And, you know, I always tell my students, if they want to understand globalization, they need to think about Pearl Harbor, because there's no question that, you know, once the United States is directly attacked, once we realize that our security is so vitally threatened, you know, Roosevelt really begins to articulate that what happens in distant corners of the world affects Americans. And mm-hmm. So the security and well-being of people that we never thought we would, you know, really have close contact with in distant continents really mattered to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to try to promote this world where you had freedom from want and freedom from fear if America itself wanted to be secure.
Hmm. When you mentioned Norman Rockwell's paintings, tell me about those.
Well, those were enormously popular. They became covers of the Saturday Evening Post, and, you know, were meant to be reflections of that very famous speech. And so, as I said, they became the Four Freedoms became in many Americans' minds the reasons why we were fighting the Second World War.
How was the speech received, the State of the Union?
It was one of his, and perhaps his most famous wartime address. It was enormously well received and a very powerful speech, as exceeded only by his brilliant Pearl Harbor address in the wake of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941.
Mm. He had such a way, when you hear the way he said just these four words everywhere in the world, the way he said it, he knew how to say everywhere in the world, didn't he? The way he phrased it is just chilling almost.
It is chilling. And as I said, it's a very much a Rooseveltian vision. And this is not a kind of singular event. This is linked to his thinking in the 1930s. This is linked to the promotion of freer trade, which his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, was promoting in the 30s and would work on it again in the 40s. This is linked to the Atlantic Charter, the creation of the United Nations. The United Nations itself, by the way, was the name of the wartime alliance, which was proclaimed on January 1st, 1942, shortly after the Japanese attack. And then it became... And during the war itself, you often saw in the press, United Nations forces attacked here and United Nations forces attacked there. And ultimately, Roosevelt decided that the international organization that would follow the war should carry the name the United Nations.
Hmm. So is it a stretch to say this, or is there some truth in saying that the war aims of the United States, the goals of our being involved in the war, would be to establish in as much of the world as we could freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. There's no question. I mean, you have to think about this. You know, the United States, after the fall of France, sent troops immediately to Brazil. We had a meeting in Havana in early July at the Havana conference, securing the kind of unified foreign policy in the Western Hemisphere. Shortly after that, you have the agreement with Canada, the Augsburg Agreement, August 1940. I mean, we were scared. We were frightened of German aggression.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great fear that the Germans would get a hold of the British fleet and would gain control of the Atlantic. As I said, we sent troops to eastern Brazil. That was the first place that we sent troops abroad, thinking that once they got a hold of North Africa, they could cross the South Atlantic, which is relatively short, and we'd find ourselves at war in the Western Hemisphere. This is the kind of incredibly tense atmosphere that existed. I think one editorial in the New York Times in July of 1940 said these are the most historic days that Americans have ever witnessed. You know, so it was a very, very serious moment. And I think, you know, what you also see in the war is Roosevelt, you know, with this remarkable ability to communicate with the American people. In February of 1942, he gave one of his fireside chats, and he actually publicized the idea that the people should buy world maps before the address. And it was the largest sale of National Geographic
really?
World maps in history.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he says, take out your maps. And he says, this is a different kind of war. It's a war on every continent, and it's a war that involves an air age. And, you know, it's Roosevelt. If you look at the symbol of the United Nations, you'll see it's a polar projection of the world, which Roosevelt promoted. Because if you look at the world from the North Pole, all the continents virtually are much closer together.
Mm-hmm.
And we're linked to Asia. We're linked to Europe. And in an air age, the distances are not that far.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and then he would make this argument. You know, you really have to worry about what happens to people in Java, because their security is ultimately linked to our security.
Hmm.
And if they are hungry and, you know, in 1944, at his famous Economic Bill of Rights speech, he said, you know, unhappy events abroad have taught us that necessitous men are not free men. Free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff with which dictatorships are made. So there was this really strong conviction that there had to be a new economic order after the war was over. And this, of course, is what leads to the globalization of the world economy, the expansion of free trade, General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, Bretton Woods agreements, International Monetary Fund, World Bank, etc. Because we couldn't afford a World War III. Not just economically, but I'm convinced Roosevelt was convinced that it would be utterly destructive. I mean, the violence meted out in the Second World War was unprecedented,
mm-hmm.
and the world would not survive a Third World War.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll start taking them momentarily. Our guest is David Woolner. He's a senior fellow and Hyde Park resident historian of the Roosevelt Institute, and was the Roosevelt Institute's executive director. He also teaches at several colleges. And we're talking about a speech that was delivered today. It was the State of the Union address by FDR, and it outlined the four freedoms and presented the reasons for becoming involved in World War II. And it was a very important speech in terms of getting people ready to embark on a war effort, but also because, and we'll talk more about this, David just mentioned some of what happened after the war, but it had a large impact on the formation of international bodies post-World War II. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for David. 800-486-8655 is our number. And Kathleen in Milwaukee. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. I hope you can hear me, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too.
I have several questions, one of which, if he hadn't brought up the Rockwell paintings, I was going to bring that up. But one of my questions was, I had heard that Rockwell had been offered death threats because there were inclusion of minorities in those paintings of the Four Freedoms? And then how much did Roosevelt rely upon the use of speech writers for his fireside chats and this sort of thing? And the third question is, there's always been these assertions that they knew that the Japanese were going to attack prior to the attack in Pearl Harbor. And I have an uncle who just recently died, but he was actually in Pearl Harbor at age 23 as an airplane mechanic when that happened. So it's always something that we've been interested in. And I just really appreciate this topic. It's just so fascinating.
Thank you, Kathleen. Professor?
Well, in terms of Pearl Harbor, that one we can deal with quickly.
Okay.
You know, the notion that there was some kind of conspiracy is really has been discredited and disproved time and time again. I mean, it's hard for people to put themselves in the context of the time. Of course, there was an awareness that Pearl Harbor was a potential target. There were warnings sent to Pearl Harbor as there were sent to other areas in the Pacific. And there was clear awareness that the Japanese were on the move. But the idea that somehow that the President of the United States would set up the U.S. fleet, naval fleet, in an effort to get us into the wars is just not credible. Now, the other questions were, about the Four Freedoms paintings. What was the question there?
That Rockwell received threats because there were minorities in those paintings?
I'm not familiar with that. I don't know as much about Rockwell's experience after the painting of the Four Freedoms. I know that the paintings themselves were enormously popular and were reproduced but as posters during the war. But I do not know about his own, whether he personally received threats as a consequence.
Mm-hmm. And speechwriters, how many speechwriters for this address?
Well, Roosevelt drafted much of his own speeches. I mean, he had speechwriter Sam Roseman and others that worked with him. But there was a kind of drafting process. And the Four Freedoms address itself is really quite remarkable because it's Roosevelt who puts in the phrase everywhere in the world and keeps using the word world. One of the original early drafts had the word international, and he took that out and replaced it with the word world. And it's Roosevelt who puts in this expression everywhere in the world. It's Roosevelt who actually comes up with the Four Freedoms, the four different freedoms and the concept of the Four Freedoms.
Mm. Eleanor Roosevelt, I want to talk about her role. A good friend of hers said, finally, and I quote, finally, her ideas took hold in the president's call for four freedoms in his State of the Union. Eleanor never claimed credit for anything her husband did or said. There's no way of tracing the direct connection between her ruminations about democracy and his conception of four freedoms, but the link seems obvious, does it?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a very important political partnership.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very important to remember that Eleanor Roosevelt was very much a part of Franklin Roosevelt's team. He was a political advisor to the president. And, of course, she had the liberty of speaking much more freely than he did because she didn't hold elected office. So she could say things that he couldn't say. And there was a kind of understanding between the two of them concerning her public pronouncements. And, you know, she frequently would check back with him about what would be useful. I mean, they were very much a political team. So there's no question that she influenced him. She particularly influenced him early in his life when she's the one who took him down to the Lower East Side to show him the tenement houses and the living conditions.
Right.
I mean, they were part of that progressive generation. But I think she really deepened his sensibilities, and that was it was a very important partnership.
We go to Chris in the Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Hi. The phone lines are frozen today, even.
Well, I'm from Minnesota originally. I don't know
are
if
you?
I should admit that, but
it's even colder there than
I'm kind
it
of
is
lonesome
here
for the cold weather, to tell you the truth.
Well, come on over. Go ahead, Chris.
I did research on the period of film history surrounding the war from the 1930s until the end of the 50s, basically. And I found out some very interesting stuff, like Joseph P. Kennedy owned part of RKO Studios, which did a whole bunch of the propaganda films for that whole period of time. And if aware of some of the stuff P. Kennedy was involved in, like the removing of indigenous people from Central America so that they could start the American Fruit Company and stuff, you should look this up. And I was just curious about whether or not, since you've brought up some art stuff that was happening during that period of time, if you're aware of the film manipulations that were going on and whether or not Roosevelt was directly involved in that or who was.
I'm not so familiar with that. Roosevelt was very interested in film and in the media. He assumed that most newspaper editors across the country were hostile to his ideas and to the New Deal. I don't know if you can imagine this, but Franklin Roosevelt held two press conferences a week for this entire 12 years in office. So by far more press conferences than any other president in history. He had a very good relationship with the press. And he also understood the power of film, and documentary film itself kind of got its start in many ways in the New Deal with Pere Lorenz and The Plow That Broke the Plains and The River and so forth. But in terms of film manipulation and Roosevelt's role or involvement in that, I really couldn't answer that.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, was there a long list of freedoms, or did he seize upon these four freedoms pretty instantaneously?
I think he seized upon them pretty instantaneously, and actually there is an earlier iteration of this in some of his notes from the late 30s. You know, as I said, he was thinking about this almost from the beginning, or really from the beginning. If you read his first inaugural address carefully, you know, he says to the American people, this, you know, his famous line, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," of course, was the one that resonates down through history. But if you read the speech, you know, he tries to reassure the American people. He says, this crisis that we're in, which, as I said, was the crisis that led to the rise of Adolf Hitler, led to the rise of the fascist forces that ultimately led to the Second World War, he said, this was not your fault. The American people, you know, we're fortunate. We live in a land of plenty. It's the distributors of mankind's wealth that have distorted, the distribution of that wealth that has made it, you know, brought us to this point of ruin. He talked about, a land of plenty where, the very sight of it languishes in the supply. We don't. It's this inequality that had crept in the 1920s and had essentially brought the country to ruin that was not sustainable. So he's very, very conscious of the fact that freedom from want is a critical issue. And is, you know, from Roosevelt's perspective, what he's really trying to do is save capitalism. How do you make capitalism work for the average American? He doesn't want to go down the road towards socialism or fascism. He's seen the anti-democratic forces afoot in the world in response to this crisis, and he's groping, and he's not quite sure. He's a pragmatic leader. He's groping for a way forward, but he recognizes that the problem of this tremendous inequality was not sustainable, that it was bad for the wealthy, it was bad for the poor, and it was no way to sustain a liberal capitalist democracy. Mm. So his real goal was to fix that, mm-hmm. and to use government to fix that.
Yeah, interesting. That certainly is an issue that we're hearing a lot about now, and some have written that the inequality that we're seeing right now is as massive as it was during the Roaring Twenties.
That's true. And I think, I really can't stress enough that they were absolutely convinced that the Great Depression was the cause of the Second World War. That was it. And so this notion of freedom from want and mm-hmm. freedom from fear was very, very important. I mean, it's a new dimension when you think about it. Freedom of speech and freedom of religion is something that we're familiar with. It goes right back to the original founding fathers. But to identify two additional freedoms, freedom from poverty, from hunger, from destitution, and freedom from violence, as being essential to basic human rights was really quite a remarkable step forward.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 800-486-8655. Let's go to Jim and Galena. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I wanted to ask some conspiracy about that Roosevelt knew there was, you know, the kind of conspiracy that caused the war with Japan. And I think that may have sprung from the idea that we cut off oil to Japan. And I think that had as much to do with them attacking us. Do you know if that's true or not?
Yes, it is true. But again, I mean, you have to kind of think about the government as it really exists, even as it exists today. There are different forces, different bureaucracies, different agencies. There's the NSA President Obama is trying to deal with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Franklin Roosevelt's no different. And during the course of his tenure, there were two schools of thought. One school said, look, we have to be tough with Japan. We have to show the Japanese that if they continue to be aggressive in Asia, we're going to make it more and more painful for them. So it was a policy of deterrence. Remember, Japan had launched a war in China in 1937. We wanted them to bring that war to an end. And instead of their bringing it to an end, they began to expand that war. They moved into northern Indochina in 1940 and southern Indochina, southern Vietnam, so to speak, in 1941. And in response to those further moves, aggressive moves, and of course this is in response to the fall of France, which took place in June of 1940. Vietnam was a colony of France. The Japanese took advantage of that. So what we did was we tried to make it painful for them to be more aggressive. But there were others in the cabinet, including Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State, who were very much opposed to that policy. They said, look, if you keep adding pressure, you're going to bring Japan to war with us. Secretary of War Stimson, Henry Morgenthau, other cabinet members said, no, the Japanese will never dare go to war with the United States. So there were there was a debate within the cabinet about that. Eventually, the move into southern Indochina was considered pretty aggressive. We wanted to stop that, and the Treasury Department put together a scheme that, in a sense, put a de facto oil embargo on Japan when Roosevelt and Hull were actually at the Atlantic Charter meeting. And in some ways, that was a policy that was sort of moved forward without the direct, I wouldn't say permission, but both Roosevelt and Hull knew what the Treasury Department was up to, but the mechanism kind of went into place faster probably than they expected.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about post-war world and the impact, if there was one. You've already indicated that there is, but let's talk more about it. The impact of the Four Freedoms thoughts and speech on the post-war world.
Well, the Four Freedoms really inspired a generation, not only a generation of Americans, but they inspired a generation of people around the world. As I said, the United States entered the war convinced that it had economic causes. We spent a great deal of energy during the war actually working behind the scenes in opposition to Great Britain. There was a lot of tension with the British. We wanted them to break up the British Empire. We wanted to break down trade barriers. And there was a quid pro quo that we demanded for the Lend-Lease Aid, which basically said that Britain had to get rid of a system that was called imperial preference, where goods among the British Empire and Commonwealth could be traded around the world tariff-free, whereas American goods could not enter the British Empire without these tariffs or would be subject to tariff. And we were very much opposed to that. We wanted a freer trade and the free movement of capital. And so there's a whole economic agenda that is developed actually during the war years itself, which begins to really manifest itself in 1944 with the Bretton Woods agreements.
Mm-hmm.
The Bretton Woods agreements set up the International Monetary Fund, which is basically to provide for currency stability, and that, of course, is very important to trade, international trade, which is what we're thinking about, and the World Bank, which was going to be a bank to try to develop or rehabilitate nations that had been destroyed by the war, because we understood that there was going to be a need to do that. But there was more to it than that. I think what Roosevelt was saying, by articulating the freedom of speech and freedom of worship and these four freedoms, He's setting a kind of aspirational goal for the world, and you're setting up the institutions to try to achieve those goals. Nobody, you know, expected instantaneously to have universal human rights born and, as soon as the war was over. But what you see is a very concerted effort to set up the institutions that would allow for the development of those ideas, both economically, as I just said, but also in bodies like the United Nations,
mm-hmm.
where you would have the General Assembly dealing with issues of health, dealing with issues of poverty, and where you had a Security Council that could act to stop aggression. Roosevelt was no fool. He understood power very, very much. He understood that the Soviet Union was here to stay. He understood Soviet power. And he also understood that if you really wanted peace in the world, you had to get the great powers in the same room talking to each other. Hence his decision to set up the Security Council with the five great powers after the war was over. So it's a kind of a two-tiered goal, as I see it. In other words, rhetorically, we're trying to create a world that is a much better place in terms of its freedoms. And, you know, in that same speech that we've been talking about, he said, freedom means the supremacy of human rights everywhere. Our support goes out to those who struggle to gain those rights and keep them. Our strength is our universe, unity of purpose. To that high concept, there can be no end save victory. Of course, he's giving this as a war speech, but... So you set this aspirational goals, but then you do more than that. You actually set up the institutions to try to achieve those goals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've been living in a world that was very much created by Franklin Roosevelt ever since.
Yeah, what a large presidency he had. What a large one. We're going to welcome more phone calls. Our guest, our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor David Woolner, Senior Fellow and Hyde Park Resident Historian of the Roosevelt Institute. We're talking about the Four Freedoms Address, which was delivered on this date, the State of the Union Address, January 6, 1941, by President Franklin Roosevelt in his annual address to Congress. And we're talking about how significant it was and how significant it has been ever since then. Here's our phone. Oh, I gave you a number, so call us and we'll chat. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can call us at 800-486-8655. We also have an email you can use, talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We always love to have you send comments there as well. Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
Hello. I'd just like to make a comment. I'm a disabled Vietnam veteran, and those four freedoms rang into the 60s, and many soldiers died in that war. Many bodies died in that war with those words on their lips. Wasn't it true that the question I have is, wasn't it true that the Republicans were totally, you know, against that kind of talk because it would get us into war, saying things like that?
That's a very good question. In many ways, the political environment in the 1930s and 40s was much, much different than it is today. You had the parties were not nearly so monolithic. Some of Roosevelt's strongest supporters, including supporters of the United Nations, the creation of the United Nations, and the promotion of the Four Freedoms, were Republicans. And some of his, and probably his harshest critics, in fact, were conservative Democrats, particularly Southern conservative Democrats who didn't like Roosevelt and didn't like the New Deal. So it was a very different political climate, and there was pretty broad bipartisan support for the ideas articulated in the Four Freedoms and in the idea of the United States playing a larger role in the world. There was an isolationist wing that was both in part Democratic and in part Republican, and that's what Roosevelt was worried about. He didn't want to return to isolationism. That's why he kept repeating over and over again that American security was linked to the security of the rest of the world. So he was concerned about that. which again is part of the reason why he articulated this vision and part of the reason why he set up those institutions that I talked about earlier to make sure the United States stayed engaged, because he felt that was absolutely vital, that the United States had to play a leading role in the world if there was going to be peace after the Second World War. Mm-hmm. But there was opposition, but it wasn't opposition based on party. It was opposition based on ideology, conservative versus liberal ideology, which in many ways was much healthier.
So as you look at the world, Professor Woolner, in the beginning of 2014, and you assess how many people on this planet have those four freedoms and whether or not more have them now than in 1941, what do you come up with?
Well, I don't have a figure in mind, but clearly Roosevelt's vision for the future is, as I said, very much with us today. I mean, the famous American historian Arthur Schlesinger was fond of saying that, you know, the world we live in is not Joseph Stalin's world, it's not Adolf Hitler's world, it's not even Winston Churchill's world. The world we live in today is Franklin Roosevelt's world. And I think that's very, very true. Both domestically in terms of our economic programs, Social Security, unemployment insurance, the kinds of programs that came to the New Deal, as well as internationally with the creation of the United Nations, institutions like the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, which came in 1947, a couple of years after Roosevelt died. So we do live in a world where America has played a leading role in world affairs, and a role that I think is inspired in large part by the four freedoms, by the need to rid the world of poverty where possible, and to promote freedom of speech and freedom of worship, and certainly freedom from fear.
Mm-hmm. But when you look at whether or not we have achieved that, would you say that there are more people on Earth right now who do have freedom of speech and religion and freedom from want and freedom from fear?
Well, I think we've made progress since 1945. There's no question about that. But it's an unachieved goal. I mean, we still have a mm-hmm. long way to go to try to achieve those goals. And interestingly enough, when you look at the Millennium Development Goals of the United Nations, Kofi Annan articulated that we really need to work on freedom from want and freedom from fear, phrases that are still very much alive in the United Nations today. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights that Eleanor Roosevelt helped draft in 1948 incorporates the four freedoms in its preamble. So the four freedoms are very much a living vision, a living idea in institutions like the United Nations. And people are still aspiring to try to achieve those goals, as Roosevelt said, everywhere in the world.
This speech obviously was a lengthy one. We've concentrated on what he said concerning the four freedoms, and he amplified on those. Were there other parts of this address that should receive, if not the same, at least more attention than they have received?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, you know, it is January of 1941. He is going before the State of the Union. He's talking about the state of the world. He's talking about the state of the U.S. economy. He's dealing with the business of the presidency and the Congress in that speech, as presidents do. I mean, they are there to report to Congress on progress they've made on various programs and so forth, and where the United States is on in world affairs. But the really big question that was before the Congress was, would we come to the aid of Great Britain? And, you know, what are we going to do now that the British can no longer afford to purchase the arms and the material that they need to defend themselves? And, you know, he has put forward this idea of taking the silly old dollar sign out of the lending of the material. In other words, he didn't want to go back to the kind of war-death situation that existed in World War One, because that was considered part of the problem that led to the collapse of the world economy. The international financial system was distorted by all the war debts that were accumulated during World War One and the inability of various nations to pay off those debts. And so, you know, he basically said, if the security of the United States is linked to the security of Great Britain, why is our manufacture of arms, why does that have to be contained to have the United States, why can't we simply give it to the British or lend it to the British in some way, shape, or fashion? They will pay us back. And then, of course, during his press conference about this, he made the famous analogy about the neighbor with the house on fire. And he said, you know, if your neighbor's house is on fire and he comes rushing over and says, can I borrow your garden hose, you're not going to say, well, are you going to pay me for it?
Right.
You're going to loan it to him. And remember, this is a time when the London Blitz is happening. People are seeing newsreels of London burning.
Yes.
They're hearing Edward R. Murrow broadcast from London live and at night. You know, so these were powerful images that he articulated, and the American people responded.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a piece maybe about a year and a half ago titled Obama's Second Term Could Mark the Return of the Four Freedoms, and you write about the president calling on the world to embrace the four fundamental freedoms again, his visit to Myanmar, and the journey that that country is taking from dictatorship to democracy. Has our current president reflected deeply on the four freedoms and made them any part of his policy proposals, or have other presidents?
Well, they've been articulated by various presidents since 1945, and Governor Cuomo quoted the Four Freedoms speech shortly after at a ceremony at the World Trade Center in a very moving address marking the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And certainly President Obama has articulated more than once, but probably the most prominent was when he went to Burma and basically use the Four Freedoms as a model, as they have been a model, as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has been a model for countries around the world trying to develop constitutional democracies. What are the basic human rights that we need to secure? You know, what are the fundamental freedoms that people need in a democracy? And, you know, these four simple ideas are very, very profound. So you do see them articulated, as I said. They're part of the UN Millennium Development Goals. They recently were brought up again at the UN in terms of what happens after 2015 and that first go-around of trying to achieve those Millennium Development Goals. We're talking again about freedom from want and freedom from fear when you think about places like Sudan, South Sudan, so forth. These are issues that are very much still alive today.
Yes, they are. And what about FDR himself? Were there any founding fathers or great philosophers before then or since then that he read very carefully and who inspired some of these ideas?
Well, Roosevelt was a great lover of history and a great reader of history. And he was a great admirer of Thomas Jefferson. He's responsible for the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, which he opened in 1943, interestingly enough. He had a great sense of community and of a great sense of the a kind of American agrarian spirit, people being tied to the land, and I think a kind of essential democracy that was present in the early part of the United States that I think he felt had been distorted by the rise of industrial capitalism. As I said, he wasn't trying to destroy capitalism, he was trying to save it, but I think he felt that there was a kind of distortion in the modern industrial society that exploited people, that no longer made it possible for them to enjoy economic freedoms. In 1936, he really focused in on this when he gave his Madison Square Garden speech, when he talked about the political equality we had once won became meaningless in the face of economic inequality. A small group had concentrated into their own hands almost complete control over other people's property, other people's money, other people's labor, other people's lives. For too many of us, life was no longer free, liberty no longer real, men could no longer follow the pursuit of happiness. So he's really linked to that idea of those basic needs of the average person. And for him, going through that war, which, you know, unprecedented violence that was meted out certainly by us as well as by others. It was a very violent conflict. Millions and millions died. 60 plus million people died around the world. You know, we couldn't go through this again. And actually, his last speech was going to be a Jefferson Day address, where he talked about cultivating the science of human relationships. Hmm. That we really couldn't return to the kind of world we'd been to before. We had to move way beyond that, because a third world war, for as far as he was concerned, meant the destruction of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was really focused on trying to make sure that we moved forward. And that wasn't going to be easy. You know, he's accused of being naive and so forth and so on, which I don't think is true. I think, as I said, he understood power and understood that there was real power out there that had to be dealt mm-hmm. with. But better to sit down in a room and try to hammer it out.
And certainly understood words. We're out of time. David Woolner, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
David Woolner, Senior Fellow and Hyde Park Resident Historian of the Roosevelt Institute, on this anniversary, 73rd, of the Four Freedoms speech, part of the State of the Union address that FDR gave to Congress in January 6th of 1941. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poussant and K.P. Whaley.